Who are you?
My name is Mud Harcourt. Fenton Mud Harry, for short. And I reiterate, ouch.
What's a civilian like you doing on a Klingon prison vessel?
The only crime I'm guilty of is loving too much. It's true, Captain. I fell for a woman far beyond my reach. Sweet Stella.
You see, gentlemen, behind every great man, there is a woman urging him on. And so it was with my Stella. She urged me on into outer space. Not that she meant to, but with her continual, eternal, confounded nagging. Well, I think of her constantly. And every time I do, I go further out into space. Stella, dear.
Harcourt? Harcourt, Fenton, Mud, what have you been up to? Nothing good, I'm sure. Well, let me tell you, you lazy good-for-nothing...
Shut up!
Thing.
Marvelous, isn't it? I finally have the last word with her.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry, and I'm joined, as always, by Graham.
Hello.
And by Derek.
Howdy.
This episode, we're going to be talking about Harcourt, Fenton, Mud. Harcourt, Fenton, Mud, Harry Mud, as he is known to his friends, those of us who would call him his friend, and I think maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. One of the most storied of the non-regular characters in the Star Trek franchise, I would think. If not the most. Don't know whether or not he's had the most appearances of a non-regular character, but he certainly spanned the longest timescale in terms of sort of Star Trek production chronology, hasn't he?
Well, certainly. I mean, he's one of the earliest guest stars on there. And obviously now he's in Discovery. He now goes across the whole spectrum there, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure listeners are aware of Harry Mudd, but there were two episodes in TOS, the original series, which is our main focus, and one episode in the animated series. And then, of course, returning in Discovery for a brief cameo, and then a full-blown Harry Mudd episode in Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, which is, I think, without too much controversy, one of the better episodes of Season 1. Maybe
certainly,
the best.
Yep. Certainly.
Certainly my favourite. Mm. From Season 1.
A lot of fun.
And then, of course, he did that short trek, which the actor who plays Mud, Rainn Wilson, directed, which was a lot of fun. Let's go back to the first appearance of Harry Mudd. Seriously early Star Trek.
Yes.
Among the earliest, possibly the third or fourth in production order.
Yeah.
Mudd's Women could actually have been the pilot episode for Star Trek, the first pilot episode.
It was one of the contenders, wasn't it?
There were three scripts, weren't there?
Yeah.
One of them was The Cage and the other one was Mudd's Women. Can't remember the fourth. I've got a funny feeling it might have been a second season episode. But anyway, Mudd's Women was a contender. And Stephen J. Kandel was hired to write it.
Yes.
And he is he wrote the subsequent episodes in TOS and TAS. But he is probably best known for his work on MacGyver. And he's a very well-known, loads and loads of
stuff. He had a big career after Star Trek. And this is very much his early part of his career. And he makes an absolute turkey, doesn't he, as far as Star Trek's concerned.
Yeah.
It's not really a turkey. I did rewatch this week before coming on the podcast. And I did think, oh, my God, this is difficult to watch, isn't it? This is really, really difficult to watch.
Yeah.
But there is the germ of a really good episode in here. But I know I said this before with other episodes that I've actually thought, you give this one a go because it actually works. But no, the horrific bits in Mudd's Women are just overlay everything. But I also looked at it as a pilot, and think, well, okay, how could this have been a pilot? How would this have sat with the TV executives or whoever? And it did make me think about the whole premise that Roddenberry said quite a lot about the wagon train to the stars thing. And if you look at it, especially that scene where, I think it's Eve, isn't it? And the miner are cooped up in his cave basically, and she's making him breakfast, and it's all a bit sort of, yeah, it's all horrible and weird and everything. But it is that whole sort of like that. That could have been a scene lifted from one of these old Western TV series.
The props were.
Yeah, where they could tell. Yeah, exactly. Where all of these writers came from, and where all these directors came from as well. This is what it was, replaying a scene. You could probably imagine that scene being just completely lifted from some other program like The Virginian or something like that. And this was, well, actually, this is exactly what he was after, wasn't it? This is exactly what he's said that he wants. So, yeah, it's all right to have Victorian ideals then, isn't it? Because, you know, you're writing a historical piece. It's sort of okay, but, you know, it just suits everyone's 1950s values as well, doesn't it? And, of course, you know, it just really jars when you think, well, no, it's meant to be a progressive programme about, you know, like the future and everything. And it's really painting a future that is really, really horrible, isn't it?
Well, it's got a space pimp. That's what it is, basically. I don't think the executives of the NBC would have actually gone with that as a pilot.
Oh, well, yeah.
This bloke comes along and he's sex trafficking.
You know, yeah, and drug dealing. And
sex trafficking, drug dealing. I mean, this is the bit.
And also, he might have killed the captain on the last ship as well.
Yeah.
There is that sort of, the captain took ill, didn't he?
So that's
how,
right.
How do you know he didn't actually sort of throw him out an airlock or something?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's lots of things about this that actually I think were really worth exploring, and they actually got away with. The whole withdrawal from the drug scene is actually really something quite powerful. And when you think about how Harlan Ellison had that very similar scenes ripped from the script in City on the Edge of Forever, and yet they're here really in a very similar way. Even the sort of like the look of the drug is similar to how he wrote it in City on the Edge of Forever, isn't it? This sort of like little crystal thing.
That sparkly
crystal thing, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Stephen Kandel conceived the character. I mean, he used, I mean, you very kindly, Graham, circulated between the three of us an interview in Starlog magazine from back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And he regarded him as a roofing salesman.
Yeah.
Harry Mudd, and as a con man. I mean, do you think that what they were trying to do was to create this kind of playful, lovable, rogue type character? And if so, do you think they were successful in doing that? I mean, what elements, Derek, of what themes from the episode do you pick up that are particularly problematic? I mean, let's spell it out for
listeners. You see, the funny thing about this is I don't actually believe I actually saw this episode the first time around.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's the first time I've actually seen this episode. I have seen Harry and Mudd before because...
There are other episodes.
And that, you know, that's a different kettle of fish to this. But you're right, it's a case of he comes along, he looks like a buccaneer.
Yeah.
You know, he's also a P.T. Barnum, a snake oil salesman. It's all of that sort of wrapped up together. But he has no actually redeeming features at all.
Well, let me...
A really bad Irish accent.
The accent is atrocious.
He loses that in that episode, yeah.
Yeah, it actually, the accent, I mean, he struggles to keep hold of the accent during the episode. And
but then he is pretending to be Walsh, isn't he?
Yeah.
So I suppose there is
He is the brother of Louis Walsh, I suppose. It's Leo Walsh, isn't it? You know. Yeah.
But because he goes under a pseudonym when he starts, is that right?
Walsh.
So he's trying to be...
Yes.
Yeah, he's trying to be Irish.
Irish.
So he's this lovable rogue, a bit of a wheeler dealer, and he's Irish. So, you know, no stereotyping going on.
Yeah, Star
there.
Trek always struggles with the Celtic accents, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I don't know why you'd say such a thing. I think you'll find, you know, Aberdeenshire's own Montgomery Scott, that accent is perfectly authentic.
Oh, but he...
No idea why you'd say
Montgomery
such a thing.
Montgomery Scott did a... Oh, Montgomery and McCoy in this episode. I was cringing.
Yeah, I mean, there's it's probably fair to say that the attitudes towards women in general, you know, don't really reflect, as you say, Graham, the progressive politics that Star Trek claims to have.
Yeah, but it does build you up to things that are going to come ahead in the series.
There is also that. I mean, are there any redeeming characteristics from Harry Mudd from this episode that we can identify? I think what Steve, bear in mind that Kandel's original script was very heavily rewritten by Roddenberry. Mm-hmm. And so we're not entirely certain how much of it is Kandel and how much of it is Roddenberry. It doesn't really matter. What matters is what we see on the screen. But are there any redeeming characteristics that you can identify from Mudd that made them think we're going to bring this guy back later on. What is it about the character that you think they look? Let's not bury this because it's an abomination. Let's bring him back.
He wasn't an abomination. I mean, the actor itself. I can't remember the actor's name.
Roger C. Carmel.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously was cut from a different sort of piece of cloth. Actually, you could tell that he was really into it. I actually read that there was an expanded. There was plenty more lines for him to actually sort of expand and sort of like do the sort of Falstaff sort of thing and go into a real sort of thespian sort of spiel. He had a scene with Uhura where he is actually trying to push on her those drugs that we were talking about.
Right.
You know, being the only other sort of female
Terrence,
in
there, yeah.
Who's actually in the Enterprise, she was actually pushed to the side quite a bit in this, actually.
Mm.
You know, but they had originally in the original script, she was actually going to play a bit more of a part.
Well, that's very interesting what you say, because I mean, that goes back to that interview that you sent around, in which Kandel says that Uhura, they had invisible, he described them as invisible walls around that character. Mm-hmm. She was there, she was present, but no one could do anything with her because she was black.
Yeah.
She's
a
black woman. The networks were just so uptight about any kind of interaction with black females.
It was almost as if there was segregation, invisible segregation on the bridge.
We would like to think that this is a thing of the past.
Yeah.
I am a watcher for my sins, for better or worse, and I make no apologies, but I watch NCIS. I'm not going to, you know, I'm sorry. I just do. I watch it. Although it's going out to the huge amount of listeners that we have. But I noticed last season, or the season before, there's been 15 of them, that Bishop, one of the characters, white female character, had a relationship with a brown man.
Yeah.
Maybe not a Muslim, but certainly a brown man, certainly originating from the Middle East. And he met a grisly end because he's a brown man and it's NCIS and that tends to happen. But also any of the rare scenes of intimacy between the two of them were never that intimate. They were always holding hands. There was no kiss or anything like that. And I'm certain that that's because a lot of the NCIS has a huge audience.
Mm.
One of the few remaining programs with a genuinely huge audience. And I'm sure that a significant portion of that would have been offended to have seen a white woman kissing a brown man, and that they left it out. So I'm afraid that that still persists today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a digression for which I apologise. Let's move on to I, Mud. Let's move on to the next episode, shall we?
Yeah.
This is a really interesting one because I want to then also tie this into the proposed notion that Harry Mudd will return in Star Trek The Next Generation, details of which I think we know nothing or next to nothing. But the reason why I want to start that, bring that in here, is because this is the robot one.
Yes.
Yes, and this is actually a good episode.
Do you like this?
But it's wonky. It's extremely wonky.
It's a comedic episode.
Yeah.
And it comes after Trouble with Tribbles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, obviously Trouble with Tribbles has gone down very, very well. And David Gerrold does have a non-credited hand in the writing of this.
You told me this just before we pressed record, and that for me that fills an awful lot of blanks, you know, of understanding when I think about that episode now, because it feels like an episode. There are two comedy episodes in Star Trek that I can really make out, and they're both from the second season.
Yeah,
and now it seems that they both had a significant hand in them by David Gerrold.
Yeah, and I think it has what Mudd's Women entirely lacks, and that is warmth about it, which is remarkable considering most of the on screen players are playing robots. But it is a wonderful episode. It's got a great start, great opening as well, with Norman going around and just messing up the ship. And that almost seems like something that that is visited back again in the next generation as well, isn't it? When with Data going around the ship and when
throwing people all over the place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the android gone rogue is a Star Trek trope born with IMUD.
Yeah,
but I mean that sequence, you know, the intro sequence is actually really well done.
Yeah,
because you know, except obviously. The bit that, how the hell did he get on there? He's an android onto a starship. We forget about that.
Yeah.
You know, and he keeps missing his medicals. Yeah, that's okay. That's also
fine.
But actually, as a sort of action sequence, it's actually really good. You know, he's going around. I mean, you know, yeah, you could sort of point out, well, where are the security guards? If something's going wrong, why aren't there sort of
they've
like...
They've got through a lot of security guards by the time they get to this stage of the series.
Yeah.
But yeah, but
red shirt on the Enterprise, you know, you wouldn't have a lot of people applying for that.
I did notice, though, that they put a stuntman in with a really dodgy wig, you know, it playing the android. You know, I don't know if you noticed that. Watch it again.
This is the problem of HD, though, you see. I think in the early days, on a tiny telly in standard def, you wouldn't have known that. Yeah. But, yeah, I see that a lot, actually, in a lot of films as well. Like, a lot of Bond stuff. A lot of the Bond stuff that wasn't made with people.
What, Roger Moore didn't do his own stunts?
Well, no, I'm going more back to
but he did do his own lying.
Actually, I was watching, I think I'm on another podcast now, From Russia With Love the other week on telly, and I was watching in HD, and you see the fight with Robert Shaw and Sean Connery and actually, no, that's not Robert Shaw or Sean Connery. I clearly recognise Bob Simmons there.
Yeah, but it's okay though because it is a cracking fight. So it is. It is one of the great fights. Yeah.
What podcast am I on there?
So this is Who Imposed Destroy. Welcome back to Who Imposed Destroy. Do check out our sister podcast, Odd Job Pod, for more sizzling James Bond takes, just like the one that you've heard. Great. Okay, so I mud them.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of this episode, although when I first saw it a few times, the first time when I was a teenager, I did enjoy it greatly. Well, that was because, you know, it was the 80s and, you know, you could objectify women in that way, you know, in a safe... The whole world was a safe space for objectifying women.
And you had a cracking phaser impression.
Oh, yeah. No. That was a cracking phaser impression, but with the finger and a... Yeah. Yes, that's
true. It was the whistling...
That's right.
I can do it, but hey,
I mean, let's just talk a little bit about Stella.
Yes.
And then I think how that all rolls out about the, you know, the portrayal of the women robots or androids, if you like.
Yeah. Well,
and where are we going with this?
All we're seeing is Mudd's projection of women. And we're not actually seeing Stella, are we? We're seeing what his projection of a Harridan wife is, isn't he?
Yes, that's right.
So she's probably not like that. Probably...
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. To be continued. Yes. We could talk about Stella shortly, in fairness. I'm not comfortable. I mean, a woke middle-aged man that I am now, I'm not comfortable with the portrayal of women in this episode. I think it's problematic. It doesn't actually, in fairness, stop me from enjoying the episode. It is a much more watchable episode. It rattles along very nicely. And it is absurd.
Yeah.
And it's deliberately absurd. And do you think that excuses some of the more troublesome aspects of it?
Yes, I think it is. And them being robots as well, they aren't women.
Mm-hmm.
So that
that's kind of worse though, is it?
But is it or not? I mean, like he's on the planet of the love dolls, isn't he?
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Are they basically? I mean, is it women as purely as objects? I mean, in this case, literally,
it's
not even a metaphorical.
There is a sequence with Chekhov when he's on the phone, and the thing is, like, he's acting like a teenage boy.
Ooh.
You know, the idea that sort of like, you know. You've been programmed by Mudd to you know, that devious, you know, sort of pervert, you know, sort of like, oh, perfect. That's just, you know. And then
I think I'm going to.
You see, the problem was is that was pretty low and actually makes you feel a bit sort of dirty, but it sort of fitted in with that and it was comedic as well. Comedy,
yeah, when I watched it when I was a 14-year-old, I didn't think it was dirty. I thought it was hilarious.
Women to be even more disturbed. Ooh,
yeah,
well,
they were people there.
They were people.
So
that's
entirely different. Isn't
well, I didn't even then. It's just the way that you had, like, with the sequence with Mudd's women, with the way Scotty and Bones were behaving when they first see these women. You know, the thing is that desk was rising up right behind them. You know, it was awful. It was really awful. This, obviously, in I'm Mudd, is a little bit better, you know, in that. But it's only a small sequence. You see, that's the thing is, through Mudd's women, it feels like the whole thing is about women's objects. While here, it felt like sort of it was a comedy thing, but it was more to do with the androids and the race of androids looking after humans and And the problems that came with that as well. And there was a proper sort of science fiction idea there, rather than the other one.
There is a lot of what are little girls made of in this episode, isn't there? Whereas that episode is played seriously, this episode, which is essentially the same thing. Old robots from a previous race are now serving a new master. And Norman is the new Rock, isn't he?
It is, so, yes, yeah. Yes, I suppose. Yeah, no, yeah, that's a great comparison. Yeah, I mean, sadly, the guy who plays Norman is not as good as Ted Cassidy,
no.
Who played Rock. But it's a different brief.
Yeah.
I tell you what, let's just skip ahead a little bit and then talk about that little short trek that Rainn Wilson, who plays the new Mud in Discovery, because obviously Star Trek Discovery spoilers, listeners, so... Be warned, I might put something at the beginning just to say. The theme of the androids is carried over into this short trek as well.
Yeah, which is funny because obviously Discovery is set before TOS, and I presume that this sequence is set before TOS with the androids.
Yeah.
So he obviously, Mudd does have...
He's got a history. With androids. We don't know this in iMud, but he obviously has a history with androids.
Yeah.
Or does he? See, my impression of those short treks is that they're outside canon. I think they're just stories that are being told with fine. No...
Headcanon. Yeah. But I know...
I'm going to take my culture out
Let's
now.
Let's face it. He's a liar. So you can't trust anything he says,
no,
can you?
Absolutely. So, absolutely. So we don't know. Who knows? Maybe that planet. He said, I didn't discover... I wasn't found on this planet. This is my planet. This is my place. Exactly. This is my home.
He always lies. Especially when he's telling you he's lying.
Oh, that, yes, that bit. But he,
now,
no,
listen
he's
carefully,
brilliant.
Derek. I am lying.
You're telling the truth now, this does not compute.
Just going to turn Derek's microphone down for a little while we reboot him. Steam coming out of computers, though. It's great.
Yeah.
What a world. I wish that was something that did go. I mean, we've seen so many technological innovations that have come and been inspired by Star Trek, but what we haven't seen is steam coming out of computers.
Keyboards actually explode.
Keyboards exploding.
Well, that's it. Poor Norman. All that steam coming behind his ears. It was quite, you know.
That is great. I did like that. And I love the way that it's that contemporary conception of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
That is a theme in Star Trek, because Kirk talking computers into destroying themselves is a thing. We see it.
Yeah.
We've seen it before. We'll see it again. And it's great. I love it. It's one of my favourite parts of the original series, is Kirk reasoning computers to death. And it's all about, on a higher level, it's about humanity's supremacy over the machine and the limitations that the machine has and stuff like that. And it's glorious.
Mm-hmm.
It's more nuanced today. But what we're seeing is a much more unnuanced sort of like portrayal of artificial intelligence, which I still actually think that even today people's fears of our AI still stem from that kind of, you know, that conception that they could end up taking us over and either making us like, you know, slaves or indolent or just dominating us in some way, and it's no good.
Well, that's the thing I found in that episode as well, the idea that sort of Kirk is horrified. That the thing is that this race of androids is going to look after humanity and give them everything that they want. He's horrified that people will be able to sit down and relax and, you know, have foot baths and
it's really, you know, weird. I mean, there's arguments that have been gone on in other forums about this. This side of paradise, the one with the spores,
yeah,
and I mean Kirk. Basically, all of these people on that planet are really happy. They're healthy. They're doing what they want, and they are content. But Kirk's like, no, this is not. That's not what I want, you know. And he ruins it all. He ruins it all for them. And it's a strong...
Now they've all got jobs.
Yeah, now they've all got jobs
and a boss.
Yeah.
I mean, now they're going on the train every morning, going, I think I prefer the spores.
And I'm thinking. Star Trek, the future of Star Trek, that our future is that we are free.
Yeah.
We're free from want and we're free from needs. We live in a post-scarcity economy. And we are free to do whatever we want to do. And we are probably educated and culturally educated to seek the best life for us. So that doesn't mean that we don't work hard. It means that we have the choice whether or not to work hard. It doesn't mean that we don't suffer. We have the freedom to suffer. It's the elimination of unnecessary suffering. And that's the thing about Star Trek Future. That's the essence of the Roddenberry vision is the relief of unnecessary suffering.
So if we want to sit in
spaceships hurtling through the vacuum of space in these incredibly hazardous environments, then that's a choice that we make, where we're being constantly monitored by an all-powerful computer and being told what to do by your boss, then that is your choice to make. But if you want to stay at home in your underpants watching whatever the Star Trek equivalent of Star Trek is all day, you can do that too. Mm. And, you know, it's all good. And but the messages that sometimes come from these episodes, that from Kirk, that are saying, no, it has to be a struggle. You know, everything has to be a struggle. It's like, no, well, we literally are got to the point where it doesn't have to be a struggle. And now you're kicking over everyone's fun.
Well, this is one of the problems with Mudd, isn't it? Is because Mudd is a late capitalist character in...
Oh, he's a big libertarian, yeah.
Yeah, in this perfect universe, this utopian universe.
Yeah.
And obviously someone like him isn't required.
No.
He's got, let's face it, he is a pimp. He's a pimp, he's a drug dealer, and these are things that if you're living in a perfect world, you don't need.
No.
But obviously this is a guy, he's obviously successful at what he does because he still does it and he still goes on and on and on.
I think they make a really valid point in the first time you see him in Discovery, actually, when he has this talk with Lorca in the prison, when they're talking about basically... You guys in the Federation are basically messing it up for us small guys, us entrepreneurs, our small businessmen out there. And you started this bloody big war and we're paying the price. But obviously he's a hypocrite anyway, because, I mean, he's going to make a lot of money. If he could, he would make a lot of money selling arms his father-in-law.
And the other thing is that he has the life. That life is available to him. It's just, I mean, this is the great reveal at the end of Magic to Make the Saints Man Go Mad, is we see Stella arrive and she's, in any respect, she's not a fishwife. She's not some battle axe.
Yeah.
She's a loving, devoted wife, albeit with a very, very dangerous, probably domineering father, sort of like, you know, there as well.
Putin-esque.
I mean, he has the opportunity to have everything that he wants and to do what he wants and presumably to run the family business in the way that he wants, but he's rejecting all of that. He's a genuinely peripheral character. He wants to live by his own... by his own rules, and no one else's. And even if he's offered a lifestyle to which he wants to live, he doesn't want to do that. And I think that was an interesting dimension that they introduced there that rounds out that character a little bit more.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I like about that is that they've clearly seen those Mudd episodes from TOS and looked at them and looked at the character, and they found the most redemptive aspects of the character and then brought it into Discovery.
Yeah.
And created a proper, well-rounded villain.
Also, yeah. I think they've got a great actor.
And Rainn Wilson is a great actor.
And he looks like he really loves the character.
Yeah.
And why the hell would you direct that little short
film? Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that is a great point, because he is... obviously, he's been given a character from the original series, and so that is something that comes with so much other stuff, and then but he just completely owns it, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen some stills with Jason Isaacs and him, and I can't remember. Oh, it's the other guy who played Ash.
All right, yeah,
and they're out actually in breaks between filming, and they're playing table tennis. And you see Rainn Wilson there, and he's all in his garb and everything like this. And he's standing there like a buccaneer and really proud of himself with his leg up, you know, with the big, big, big boots, while sort of Jason and the other actor, I can't remember, terrible, sorry, they're playing table tennis. And it really looks like they're having a great bit of fun. But also you can tell that Rain really loves dressing up like that character.
It's really interesting that they decided to bring Harry Mudd back. I mean, what we've just been talking about here, I mean, if Harry Mudd, I think, was alive today, I mean, he'd either be a proper villain.
Yeah.
Or he would possibly be the head of a... He'd probably be some Brexit head of startup kind of guy. He'd be a little bit more... Yeah, and he, with considerably more charm.
Yeah, he'd have 6 million followers on Twitter, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would really be, you know, leading that. He'd be a disruptor. He'd call himself a disruptor.
Yeah. Yes.
And he'd complain. I mean, he'd probably be a horrific asshole.
Yes.
But...
He is in these.
I mean, there's some wisdom, I think, in bringing him into modern Star Trek, because this is the kind of people that dominate our social media, and our politics.
Yeah.
And so to bring in someone like Harry Mudd and really to expose him for being what he is, from my perspective, and I'd like to hear whether or not you agree with this, shows these kind of outlier, roguish characters that dominate our politics today for being the kind of person they are. Mudd helps me pass those kind, I won't name names, but pass those characters and saying, you're just Harry Mudd, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he is. I mean, like, obviously someone you cannot trust, but someone that you want to believe what he's telling you because he's offering you something that you really want. Mm.
But also dangerous, criminal, and patient, willing to wait and wait until he gets his moment.
You can also tell by the choice of name. The name Mudd. Mudd is obviously, you know, I come from a European perspective. We don't actually have the same thing that the Americans do. Because the thing is, Mudd, wasn't he the guy who killed Abraham Lincoln?
No.
No, oh, no, he was the guy who helped. He was the doctor who helped. When Abraham Lincoln was killed, I can't remember the assassinate.
John Wilkes Booth.
That's it, John Wilkes Booth. When he escaped, because he escaped, and he ran off and he was treated by a doctor called Mudd.
Oh.
So Dr. Mudd, and then that phrase, your name is Mudd, afterwards he was treated as a pariah. I think that actually has a resonance there that probably we don't see.
No.
It's a fun name.
Mm.
Harry also is quite a sort of, you know, sort of cool. I mean, the idea about Harcourt Fenton, it starts off, his parents, whoever called him Harcourt Fenton, you know, they've given him a poshy type name, you know, sort of like Lord Fauntleroy sort of thing. And they might have wanted him to be something else than he did, and he becomes a rogue instead.
Maybe there is a bit of a Farage thing going on there, because, I mean, like, Nigel Farage is really Nigel Farage, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he affects the Farage, and, you know, I mean, like, Harry Mudd was actually born Harry Mudd, but he has chosen, perhaps, include it in order to, you know, give himself a little bit more standing in his and other people's eyes. I we'll probably wrap things up quite soon, but I want to. I mean, there was a decision to bring Hamad back in. After what we've been talking about, there is some poetry, I think, in bringing this character back into Discovery at this point. He was due to come back in Next Generation, which would have been interesting because they might have gone from Mudd's Passion, which we haven't talked about, which is the animated episode, and I don't think we need to talk about that. But unless you want to talk about that,
no.
But if they had used Iron Mudd as a jumping off point, then they might have done an android story.
Mm. Yes.
With Data, which might have been really interesting.
That might have been fun.
And we might have seen, I mean, I personally, the speculation might be that what they were doing is that they would be comparing Mudd's androids as more like life model decoys or automatons, whereas Data is a person.
Yeah.
And highlighting the difference between just simply a sex toy and a rounded individual sentient creature that Data is. And we might have got some interesting Star Trek out of that.
I'm sure you would. I mean, the thing is also, remember in Iron Mudd, you've got a planet full of androids who are superior androids compared to later on robotic sort of thing. I'm sure that someone would have gone there and done a bit of, you know, retroconning or taking bits and pieces out. I mean, Noonien Singh would have done something, taken a couple of bits.
I think we bring that name up every time there's a robot in TOS, isn't there?
Well, you always do reconcile with you because it is such an interesting thing. I mean, the truth is this, Star Trek TOS was an anthology series. And the reason why canon is there were continuities all over the place is because the writers didn't care about
it.
Told not to. Write Star Trek. Mm. These are anthology stories, but with the same characters. Yeah. It doesn't matter what happened last week.
And then you have
week.
Nuggets that actually sort of stick, which is like Harry Mudd, you know.
But sticks like Mudd, yeah. So, But
it all links.
But yeah, but it, as soon as Next Gen starts, the only line of android is the other android stories
have effectively been done
because there's only one show in town now.
If you want to retcon it, then you could start talking about Soong-type androids and about the construction of a positronic net and a positronic brain, and that you could say that Data is not just an android. Data is a person. We're creating a person, and we're not creating robots that look like people and are programmed to behave in such a way.
Interestingly, though, with the when the robot guts, when he lifts up his shirt, shows his guts, they're all remastered. They're all updated. Yes,
are they?
Yes, yes, yes. If you look at the original, it looks like you're opening up a 1960s radio.
And of course,
in the new one, it's all gold, like. Sort of,
It's all
quite flush.
No, I'm not happy with that.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that out.
I'm not happy about it already. Yeah.
And I haven't even seen it yet.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, but you were saying that sort of like Harry Wood has returned in Next Generation, but he was also, obviously he's appeared in fiction quite a lot, you know, sort of like Star Trek fiction. And I found that he was actually he appeared in the Golgi comics.
Yeah,
in the last episode, episodes of that, and that was...
he also appears in DC Comics as well.
Aha, okay.
It turns up in there, and also if you're interested in your JJ verse, there is a Mud character in the build up to Countdown to Darkness, which is the miniseries there, and it's a female, younger woman called Mud. Interesting. Don't know anything about that, but that's stuff that the listener, can take forward and do your own researches to get back in touch with us if you want to.
I think he was meant to turn up in the third series, but
he was otherwise busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roger C. Carmel had a gig.
Yeah. I don't know if that story is the one that Candel used for the animated series.
Mad's Passion. I don't know either.
May well have been. It would probably have been quite poor.
Yeah. And of course he was in Batman.
And he was in Man from U.N.C.L.E. and other stuff. And we are now out of time. We must draw a veil on this conversation. No, that's not the right reaction. Well, we are now out of time.
Oh.
And must draw a veil on our conversation about Harry Mudd. There is much more that we could have talked about, but I think we have kind of ticked all the boxes here. A problematic character, but one that actually goes all the way back to the genesis of Star Trek itself. They were writing about Harry Mudd before they were writing about Captain Kirk, because it was one going to be the Cage. So it was this is Cage era stuff. Harry Mudd goes all the way back there. So an important character and worthy of discussion, problematic and troubling at times, but I think reinvented really beautifully by the writers, producers, and by the actor who plays Harry Mudd in Discovery. So great stuff. Wonderful. Guys, is there anything else you want to add? The answer is no. Great. Because we really have to go because we have a train to catch. So, without further ado, I shall say thank you very much indeed for listening. And from myself, Terry, and from Derek, and from Graham, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.